to decide. So
Sorry, I'm having technical difficulties, but I swear this is the last time I think.
Anyway, so the structure of the tuition is defined by or allowed by RCW for the state board to define, but the actual increases are set in RCW, and that is by the 14-year rolling average of median hourly wage in the state of Washington. So that is that is the statistic that's calculated that gives us the authority or how much we can increase tuition in any given year. So operating fee is what we think of as tuition. Tuition fees are separately defined in 28B.15.020, and it's really basically operating fees plus our building fee. So 28B.15.067 is the process for increasing tuition operating fees, which is never defined, but implied to be the operating fee portion of tuition fees. And then once again, that is that thing that we were just talking about where it's based on that 14-year rolling average. The building fee portion of tuition fees has a separate system for how its overall increase can be calculated. And it is not based on hourly wage, it's based on inflation. And so that's why our overall tuition fees, when we send out the information each year, updating what those will be for the next year, may not look exactly like what either one of those separately look like, because each part, operating fees and building fees, goes up at a different rate, right? So we get that question, or at least I did at the colleges a lot, where students would come and I'm really confused. Tuition was supposed to supposedly go up by what, 3.2%, and it's this is going up by, I don't know, 3.4%. What gives? And it's because what at during that particular year, the hourly wage rate went up by a lower rate than the CPI did, which meant that there was a higher rate of increase for building fee than there was for operating fee. And then when you do the weighted average of those, it actually ended up higher than what the operating fee increase was supposed to be. Deborah has her hand up.
So, is there a particular source for those increases specified in the RCWs? Like you're supposed to use the 14 rolling average based on such and such from the state actuary's office or anything like that?
Actually, it prescribes the data source and it prescribes who's supposed to do it. So the data source is the Federal Department of Labor's labor and statistics that data that and actually it's got this weird definition that of which data set at the Bureau of Labor Statistics you're supposed to use that seems like it's more flexible than it actually is because it's defined to be the rate for basically it's the rate for the entire state of Washington. It's the statistic geographic and demographic statistical area that encompasses all of the state of Washington. And so that's the portion. And then OFM is cited as the organization that's supposed to take that and then calculate out what that 14-year rolling average is. And so we at the state board actually get a document that we send on to back every year from officially from OFM stating this is what the increase for next year is based on the RCW.
Thank you.
The college affordability program is something to keep in mind because it's also in there. And oh, there's a typo. It's 28B.15. Not 18B. 28B.15.066. And what that is that there's a general fund appropriation for all higher ed, both 4 years and 2 years, to offset a tuition fee decrease that was mandated by the legislature in 2015. And so, what they basically in 2015 said is, we think tuition overall is too high. So we're mandating that you have a negative increase for next year for the fiscal year, the 2015-16 academic calendar year. And because we know you're going to lose a lot of revenue from us forcing you to decrease tuition, we're going to give you more money in your base funding, basically, or your appropriation. And then instead of increasing that backfill, which is technically like tuition coming to us in a different way, that doesn't increase by the same rate as the tuition fees. It increases by using the CPI for Washington. So once again, another really weird thing where we have multiple things that are increasing supposedly the same thing, all being calculated in different ways because the RCW tells us to calculate them in different ways. And then building fees, 28. I keep. I must have had a typo in the and copied and pasted it or something. It's 28B.15.025. And then once again, so that's where they're defined. It's the increases are set via a formula in RCW 28B.15.069, and it's a crazy formula that's interpreted differently across higher education. That's all I will say is it has all sorts of like if this, then this, then this other thing, but not in case there's a full moon on a Tuesday kind of things. And so that has been interpreted in a different way from basically from 4 years to 2 years. We've interpreted it to allow us to raise the building fee at actually slightly higher rate, not like crazy higher rate, but just slightly higher rate than what the 4 years have. But this RCW is so poorly written that it's not even clear who is responsible for making those calculations. Because I interpret the RCW 28B.15.069 to clearly state that OFM is supposed to do those calculations, which also makes sense to me just structurally because they do those calculations for every other increase. But OFM feels strongly that that's not what it says, that that their interpretation is that they were supposed to do it once at the inception of this RCW, and then colleges were supposed to independently do it from that point on, which is how we've sort of ended up in this weird place where we have different rates that we're using. Questions or anything on that one? Services and activities fees are defined in 28B.15.041. This is one of those weird ones because every once in a while I get this question, which is, do colleges need to even collect these to begin with? That, we have and it's generally with a college where they're saying that they have such a high fund balance in their SNA that it just seems silly to even charge it. And the RCW actually says you must charge and collect an SNA fee. The fee increase is also defined in 28B15, and it says that it can't increase by more than the tuition fee increase unless that increase is insufficient for debt service on student-approved COP. So a lot of colleges will have a COP that was taken out to do like a building improvement for a student center or build a student center or build a gym or those kinds of things. And those are paid for through either a separate specific fee or through the general SNA. And if for some reason the increase calculations that are done for tuition makes it so that you can't increase your SNA fee enough to meet your obligations for COP payments, then the rate of increase on SNA is allowed to go up high enough to cover that debt service requirement. Okay. Which makes sense. The state wants to protect its own credit rating, basically. And so if there was money pledged or a fund pledged to pay COPs, they don't want anybody to default on those.
I've got another question.
Yeah.
So we actually have a separate fee assessed for a building that we built, the Student Rec Center. Does anything change with that fee when the COP is paid off?
Yes. If your fee clearly or only stated that it was going to pay for the debt service, then it has to go away once your debt service, your COP is retired. If the fee stated that it was for debt service and ongoing maintenance and operation, then you can continue to collect the fee for the purpose of maintenance and operation of the building. So the wording of what students voted for is a key piece of what happens to the fee after the debt service was retired.
Thank you.
Technology fees, RCW 28B.15.051 is also specifically defined in RCW, must be voted in by students. The expenditures are limited to technology access for students, including internet access. Its increases must be approved by student government if you're going to increase them. But there's no formula for what that or cap on what that increase would be. But if you wanted to go in and increase that fee, it would have to be approved by student government. And an annual budget must be approved by student representatives, whether that's student government or a separate group of students. The annual budget must have a group of students or student representatives, and it is plural, as part of the setting of that budget. This is the fee. Deborah, that you were talking about, this voluntary fees of students. That's for things like COP debt service or maintenance and operations of a student center or a gym or other things that the legislature won't separately fund or specifically fund. So voluntary fees of students must be voted in by students and must be for quote unquote student purposes. So that those are the only two real restrictions on that. And so those are fairly loose. There has been in the past issues brought by students, basically like 5 years after the vote, saying, "Well, wait a second, how come I'm bound to pay this when I wasn't here when it was voted in?" And the answer is 28B.15.610 says so. So that's the legislature passed an RCW that says that that's how it works. Sorry.
See class fees fit in.
What was that?
Where do course and class fees fit into this?
Well, I'm glad you asked. local fees. So local boards, so your college boards of trustees have broad authority to charge local fees in order to quote unquote operate all existing community colleges in its district. So that's RCW 28B.50.140, subsection 1. So that's things like student housing fees, self-support educational programming fees, contracted education programming fees, and class consumable fees, lab fees, all of those kinds of things. So those are under the jurisdiction of your local board. And they, once again, they get to make the policy decision that it's necessary to operate the college, and then they get to pass the structure of that fee, the increases to those fees, etc.
Joy, I got a question in chat here from Cliff. It says, should student SNA budgets be approved by the boards also, by Board of Trustees?
Actually, yes. It ultimately the board is responsible for the SNA budget. The board can actually adopt an SNA budget that the student body didn't I won't say approve, but is against what the student body government is recommending to them. So ultimately, the board has full authority, but there is a process in RCW around what happens if the or what the board needs to do if they're going to adopt a budget that's against the recommendation of the student government. And it's basically like a hearing process or there has to be a way for student government representatives to tell the board why they think they're making a mistake, basically. But the board ultimately has final say in the adoption of an SNA budget. Fines. So s things like, your library fine for not returning a book or those kinds of things. Fines are not legally considered to be a fee. It's a penalty for an action or inaction that violates a college policy. And fines can be changed by the local board and are not subject to limitations on increases. So fines are once again under local jurisdiction of the local Board of Trustees, and there's no RCW or other things that say you can only make a fine go up by a certain amount, those kinds of things. So Initiative 601 and the fiscal growth factor. So this still exists, Initiative 601. It can be put aside temporarily by the legislature if the legislature feels like it's necessary in order to make the budget work. There was some talk about that even in this session, but in the end, that was not set aside. This only matters for mandatory fees other than fees that have increases defined by RCW. So if you have a locally approved mandatory fee, then the increase in every year on how much that fee can go up is limited by the fiscal growth factor. So Initiative 601 was passed in, I want to say, 2000 or 2001, somewhere in there. 99 maybe. And it was one of the Tim Iman initiatives from years and years ago that said that they tried that tried to limit the growth rate of revenue coming into states, the state and various agencies. And so it passed, and it basically said, hey, there is a fiscal growth factor, and it basically is a calculation that's a combination of population and inflation, and it fixed the growth of fees and taxes at that rate, at that fiscal growth factor rate. According to the AG, the term mandatory fee includes charges mandated for a governmental service or privilege, but would not include charges in commercial transactions where the state participates as a party to a contract or as a seller in the marketplace. So what that means is anything that you charge in your bookstore or for food service, childcare, parking, et cetera, those are pass-through charges that are not subject to the fiscal growth factor. And then if you want to have to know a lot more, you can go to the University of Washington's I-601 growth factor webpage. That's one I use most of the time to do calculations on behalf of colleges when they ask me. And when you get this this PowerPoint, that's a live link that will take you there. So that's sort of the defining the landscape of fees. And so with that, then we can talk about waiving those fees. So once again, let's start with statutory authority. Local college boards do not have the authority to create a local operating fee waiver unless the state board permits them to do so. Okay. So in statute, the authority to do waivers of the operating fee, right? Those are granted to the state board, not to the local boards. Okay. So 28B.15.915, community and technical colleges, subject to state board policy, may waive all or portion of the operating fees for any student. So a lot of times when there's discussion at a college about, oh, we want to do this waiver, this particular way, we want to waive English 101 for operating fee for this very specific group of students, they point to this RCW, the community and technical, right, may waive all or a portion of the operating fees for any student. What they fail to recognize a lot of times is the subject to state board policy part. And so that becomes an issue. So the state board policies generally pass on the authority to local boards for any statutorily optional waivers, right? So if there's a waiver that exists in RCW where it says optionally colleges may waive X or Y or Z, then the state board policies generally just pass that on and say, okay, anything that's in statute that's an optional waiver, go for it. Okay. The place where local boards have authority to independently waive is for their local fees, right? So that list that we talked about a couple of seconds ago, right? All of these kinds of things, the class consumable fees, contracted educational programming fees, self-support educational programming fees, student housing fees, those kinds of things, the local board ha does have the authority to create a waiver for. And they don't need state board approval for that. There are some statutorily mandated waivers. So these are waivers where the legislature says you're going to waive this, and the state board can do nothing about that. And really, technically, neither can your board, your local board. So the state board can't bypass legislative intent. So whether the state board grants explicit authority or not, local colleges must implement statutorily mandated waivers. So these are waivers like 28B 15.520, children and spouses of police or firefighters killed or injured in the line of duty. And so the quote there is shall waive all of tuition fees and SNA fees, right? So that means operating fee, building fee, and SNA fee. RCW 28B.15.621, children and spouses of military members killed in action, missing in action, or POW, or injured in active duty shall waive all tuition and fees. Okay. And then a wrongfully convicted person and their children must waive all tuition and fees. So now, where this is particularly an issue for colleges is if you have a program that has very, very high expensive class fees. So I'm thinking about one particular situation that's happened where a college has an aviation program, and the fee per hour to operate an airplane is unbelievably expensive. And so they pass that fee along to their students, and that's absolutely normal in that particular academic field. If a person coming, a student comes to you in one of these categories, you have to waive all those fees, including the hourly airplane fee. And so that, there's just no choice about that given the wording of the RCW.
So it sounds like the first one is just the tuition and SMA.
Yes.
Second two are even any locally imposed fees. It's every.
Exactly. So locally imposed fees are not required to be waived, but for the police or firefighters killed or injured in the line of duty, but they are for the military, KIA, MIA, POW, and also the one for convicted person and their children. Joe Major.
Hey, thank you, Choi. All right, so just to carry on with Deborah's question, what about like application fees, parking permits, things like that? Is that also contemplated and included in fees?
It is.
Okay, thank you.
So your statutorily optional waivers, there are tons and tons and tons and tons of these, and they're distributed everywhere in the RCW. There is no, it'd be nice if they cleaned up the RCW so they all put them like in the same place. But what you have to sort of run through the RCW with a fine-tooth comb to find them all. Local, so like 28B.15.740 is the local waivers that are permitted for needy students. And needy students is so really loosely defined in that RCW. There's an RCW for to create an optional tuition waiver, tuition or operating fee waiver for the long-term unemployed, age 60 plus students, state and K-12 employees, and veterans who didn't go to war, which is an interesting category because there is one for veterans who did go to war. So, but then they went back and added a separate one for veterans who didn't go to war. In all of these, the statutorily optional waivers allow you to waive operating fee, but not building fee. That so, and there is a reason for that. The building fee goes for a number of things, including debt service for COPs that build major construction projects on our campuses. And the legislature doesn't want to take the chance that that'll get underfunded to the point where they can't do the debt service. So generally, most of these are the vast majority. There's maybe a one or two out there somewhere, but will only allow for the waiver of the operating fee side.
What about the apprenticeship waiver?
So you keep doing this.
Sorry. Have questions.
The next slide. There are some state board mandatory waivers. So the like I said, the state board also has the statutory authority, right? We talked about it a couple slides ago that says subject to state board policy, has the colleges have the opportunity and responsibility to do waivers. And so there are some state board mandatory waivers where the state board has said, we're going to force all colleges to waive the operating fee for, and then ABE, ESL, and GED prep courses, and then also apprenticeship. That's that 50% waiver issue. And so that, that's an interesting discussion because that's, as part of all sorts of conversations we've been having over the last couple of years over fiscal sustainability of colleges, that's coming up because that is not a legally mandated or legislatively mandated waiver. It is a locally done waiver by the state board. It's at the board level, and there's all sorts of politics around if the state board were to get rid of that waiver. There is a limitation on the total amount of operating fees that we're allowed to waive as a whole. And so this is one of the reasons why there needs to be state board involvement in waivers. For CTCs as a whole, it's 35% of the total operating fee. And some of the statutory waivers, both the optional side as well as the mandatory side, specifically say, hey, you don't have to count these waivers as part of the cap. So you're allowed to subtract those out and still have your 35%. We do a waiver report to the legislature. It's due on January 31 of odd numbered years. This January 31, we put one in, and it's supposed to define every single waiver we did, how what its total was, and so and then also make sure that we give them what our total operating fee collection was, so that they can assure that it was under 35% of all of that. So if you as an individual college suddenly decide, oh yeah, we're going to run off and do this waiver, it could end up being the last waiver that puts the system over that 35%, which is why you shouldn't do that without coordinating with the state board. Oh, here's one. And this is something that you can use to yell at people on your campus. Waivers that are not officially adopted by the legislature or the state board or the local board are considered a violation of Washington State's constitutional ban on gifting public funds, right? So if you have a department that suddenly decides, oh, yeah, we're going to waive whatever charge, and that hasn't gone through a process, if it's a local fee through your board, or if it's a statutorily optional waiver through the state board and your board, then your college is guilty of violating the state constitution, Article 8, that bans gifting of public funds. So you can use that to yell at them and say, you shouldn't do this. Why do you hate the Constitution of the state of Washington? Non-resident tuition differential waivers. Okay, so there's two different approaches to this defined in statute. And this is one of the areas, once again, where things get a little bit confusing, because colleges have two approaches that they can take. So, approach number one is defined in RCW 28B.15.915. And this is a state board approved waiver, which is the waiver of non-resident operating fee differential. And it only applies to the operating fee, not the building fee. So, and this is where a student can come in from out of state and pay basically, local tuition, right? In-state tuition in some sense. And there's categories of students that qualify for these waivers, including things like athletes, athletic waivers, those kinds of things. But it's general. Every college has the ability to adopt that fee differential waiver and move forward accordingly. There's another RCW, RCW 28B.76.685, and it's called it's entitled the Border County Higher Education Opportunity Project. But there's only specific colleges who can use this approach. CBC, Clark, Lower Columbia, Grace Harbor, and Walla Walla. And It has very specific requirements on the type of student that can qualify under this one. And it's a student that currently lives in Washington whose immediate prior residence was one of 13 specific counties in Oregon and lived there for at least 90 days. So it can't be just a transitory, well, I was there for a couple of days and then I came to one of these colleges. So they had to sort of basically be a resident of those 13 counties in Oregon. And once they move across the border, and start to live in Washington, then and go to one of those five colleges, then those colleges can just call them residents, right? They can just be categorized as a resident for purposes of tuition. And so they pay local resident tuition. And that means because they're classified as a resident, they pay local in-state operating fee, in-state building fee, in-state S&A fee, if there's such a thing, right? Everything for them is for the sake of your collecting of fees, as if they're just a normal, everyday Washington State resident. Okay. So that is not a waiver. And so that doesn't count against the total waiver amounts. That's not a waiver. It is just simply saying that those students are defined as local or Washington State residents for the purpose of tuition collection, right, or fee collection. And so I know that there's been and there's different I think part of the nomenclature difficulty is that we claim waiver codes that cover those two situations where one really isn't a waiver, and then do work at the back end to in our reports and stuff to show that they're not waivers. Excuse me, Deborah.
By any chance, do we have some kind of reciprocity agreement with Oregon where some of our students get treated the same?
Yes, that's why this was is this way. So there's a matching Oregon statute that is for certain community colleges and certain counties of residence for Washington students that when they move across, they get immediate Oregon residency for tuition.
Thank you.
I don't believe there's an equivalent one for Idaho anymore. There used to be, but Idaho rescinded theirs, so then we rescinded our part of that reciprocity. Oh, that's it. That's all I have. There's probably questions.
Choi, this is Jackie.
Yes.
So I know that you talked about it, but I just want to reiterate because we get this question a lot from colleges. So with the waivers, they have to apply specifically to a group, like a group of students. So if you give a specific waiver to one student, you have to give it to every student that would qualify for that category. So it can't just be a one-off for a particular student. It has to apply to a group, and all people within that group have to be eligible for that waiver.
That is correct. You have to define the group. And not only that, but you also have to have the state board has to have already passed that category as well of waiver, passed you, the local board the ability. Joe and then Sharon.
Hey, thanks, Choi. So this one gonna go a little bit off script, but it's specifically in regards to the building fee. I remember during the presentation of the potential or the recommended changes to the resource allocation model, there was a discussion about international ed and not being allowed to be accounted for state support. You know, the 2% we're doing now. And then there was a discussion about, oh, we need to send this back to the work group because it had some unintended impact on the building fee or something. I didn't quite understand that. Could you explain that? Or we can talk offline if this would be too long a
No,
discussion.
it's fairly straightforward. So building fee is defined in RCW, and it's charged to students who are paying tuition fees, right? Tuition fees is operating fee plus building fee. Your international students who are not counted as state FTE don't pay tuition fees. They pay a contracted education fee. And because of that, there is no building fee component of that. And so that yields this weird thing. If we stop counting all of our international students, and then that means that all of those revenues would move over into the category of locally defined contracted fee. And so all of that building fee revenue would go away. Here's my our countervailing argument to that, which is it may not make any practical difference anymore, because since colleges are not at their target, right? Does it really matter whether they meet their target or not? Because they're all under their target. And the only reason to be worried about whether you're under your target is if other colleges are above their target and they'll steal your FTE funding. So if we're at a point where no one is over their FTE target, then it would be really dumb to have any of your students, international students, counted as FTE, because then you're voluntarily paying a building fee and other fees that you don't have to. So my guess is that if we go and start to really dig into that, there's very few FTEs coming from the international side. And so the impact on building fees probably at the moment pretty minuscule. But that's speculation based on strategery.
Strategery.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, Choi.
Okay. Sharon.
Yeah, I just had a question about the beta and the ABE ESL fee. That's a $25 fee. And maybe this is a little bit out of your wheelhouse, but you probably know the answer. Recently, when we applied for a state board grant, they were seemed to be requesting, and maybe we just misunderstood, that we kept those fees separately. I mean, we track them with a separate fee, but we keep them separately so we can show that they're being reinvested into the program. Do we have to keep those in a separate department number, or can they can
No,
be rolled in with our
it
tuition
is
as long as we
that
have the number?
whoever at the state board was requesting that was
Yeah.
not
Well,
doing it
it
because there's
might be just
any.
like confusion on our part, you know. I'm just wondering.
It's not because there's any statutory requirement to keep them separate or anything else. Really, what that is, you know, we call it a $25 fee. What it is, it's tuition, right? It's the
Right?
remnant
I
of what's
agree. Totally
not
agree.
waived. You know, it's the remnant of what's not waived for the tuition side.
Right. Okay, perfect. I just want to make sure I didn't have to set up something special, you know, like everybody else. We're probably, you know, we're spending billions of dollars more than we get in on that, right? So, okay.
Oh,
So
yeah, no
much.
doubt.
So Choi, this is Jackie again. So for that $25 fee, we have been trying to make sure that colleges break that out into the tuition components. So they shouldn't even really be going to a separate department. They should be breaking up into the operating and
Operating and
the
building fee and et
three and a
cetera.
half. Yeah.
No, there should be a tuition distribution on that, because it really is just the remnant of tuition that isn't being being waived. Which also means that if there are requirements in state board defined grant programs or whatever that ask you to quote unquote reinvest that $25 or whatever, A, that's pretty much impossible to track, and B, that's dumb. So,
Well, apparently it was at the federal level, I
oh,
understand.
interesting.
Was a federal requirement?
I
I don't
mean, the
know.
feds can do all sorts of weird, stupid stuff. So I mean, I have no control over that.
But, well, none of us, right? So as far as you're we're concerned, then we do not need to Keep it separate. Okay, perfect. Thank you.
So I have a question from Rosa in chat that said, would you go over the difference between a waiver and a write-off?
Oh, okay. So a waiver is a statutorily defined act where we're allowed to pre-decide not to collect a certain revenue stream, right? So, and the reason is that either the legislature or the state board or your local board has made a policy decision that it's better for your community, better for students to not collect whatever normally would be required to be collected. So and the big deal is that that is a predefined policy action that's made by the board. And it affects a group of students with whatever criteria they sort that want to sort that. A write-off is where you take a debt that's owed to your college after the fact, after the students actually signed all the agreements, done all the stuff, and said, yes, I'm going to pay you. And you go through all of your actions to try to collect that debt and eventually get to the point where you say, it would cost us more to collect this than it's worth. And then you can go through the process of the write-off. It's well, sort of go through the process of the write-off. There's all sorts of weird rules in place because of that silly section, Article 8 of the Constitution thing. So technically, we don't really write off in the sense of true write-offs. What we say is we are just never going to try to collect this debt because it wouldn't be worth it to do so. We would spend more to collect it than we would actually get from that person. And so that's technically different than saying you're truly writing it off.
Okay, the next question in chat, Brett is asking for a friend. What was the RCW 28B.15.621 veterans waiver? Was that for total disability or any partial disability?
Any partial disability? No. That one's a quick one.
Okay, you're caught up in chat.
Okay. Well, I guess Whisk and IC must be way more chatty because we scheduled an hour for them and we went like almost two. But so that's how I came up with 90 minutes for you guys. But I'm more than happy to give you some time back if you want. But I'm here to answer any other questions. Well, okay.
This is your chance, guys. We have Choi. Come on. Something
Sarush,
not to do.
old friend.
Christina here from Renton Technical College. I had a question for you about specifically the employee state waiver and continuing education fees. Can we use that waiver for continuing ed fees?
You cannot. It's specific to state FTE tuition. However, your board has full authority to do whatever it wants with your local fees like continuing education. So they can create a local waiver if they wanted to. But I would be very, very careful going down that path because that can get out of hand really fast. For lots of reasons, but I know a lot of colleges do things like Ed2Go, right, in their continuing ed, where they basically act as a middle person for online education offerings from like a national company. And if you say, oh, we're going to allow for waivers for any state employee to take those courses, you're going to lose a lot of money really fast.
Yeah, thank you.
Sarush.
Hi, Joey. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Nice. I have a question. I don't know if it's in the state borders or other colleges or not, but we have a thing in a shoreline, and I just want to make sure that we're good on that. We have an internet, since we're talking about the international students and fees, what about the SNA fee and international students? If they're contracted, do they need to pay? Do we need to
They
charge
are
them?
not obligated to pay the SNA. The same way your running start students aren't obligated to pay SNA. Most colleges do some sort have an internal policy where they distribute some portion of SNA from those fees, right? So that they automatically just say, we're gonna treat it as if they're paying SNA and transfer that money over. But other colleges don't. So it really that's a local decision.
Thank you.
Okay, in chat, do veteran waivers apply to ASC voted fees?
ASC.
I'm guessing that's student,
Oh,
associated
student.
student clubs or student committees.
Depends on which waiver. Some of the waivers say all fees, and some of the waivers say just tuition and tuition fees. So, if it says all fees, then it's all fees. If it just says tuition fees, then it's only tuition fees.
So, Choi,
Yes.
how tightly defined are pass-through fees?
They're pretty tightly defined. I mean, a pass-through fee really is designed to be something where you don't mark it up, you don't do anything other than you just say, okay, for the sake of, an example might be for the sake of just ease of administration and making sure that students all have the same tool set, the folks in your building construction program might all have the ability to buy a toolbox full of tools from the program rather than going and sourcing it all separately. But you're not really making a profit on that. You can charge a nominal fee for the administration of it and the sorting of it and those kinds of things. But overall, you would be just passing through the cost of those tools. So yeah, it's fairly strict in terms of what is a pass-through fee.
What about software?
I think very similar. If you're
Where
passing
you're
on like a
paying
licensing
or
fee,
charging for a licensing fee, yeah.
yeah, if you're charging a licensing fee, those kinds of things, no one's probably going to argue if you tack on a marginal, like this is what it costs us to administratively pa actually pay the vendor and distribute the license keys to every individual student and those kinds of things. But it is just a and the reason that those are exempt from any of the increase statutes and those kinds of things is because you don't know, and the legislature doesn't know how much those are going to go up in any given year. If it's somebody like Microsoft, it may go up 3% one year and 10% the next year and those kinds of things.
So, but what if it isn't a specific student license, per student license situation?
Well, then that would
That
probably
then.
just be a lab fee. So if you're thinking about, okay, well, it costs us a certain amount of money to put all this software on a computer in a lab and students get to access that, then if it's vitally important for their program or whatever, that would probably be like a lab fee.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Joe Major.
Hey, Choi. All right, since you asked for us to ask questions. All right, so yesterday I attended the state tax conference with Washington Society of CPAs. Okay, so someone there gave an update on legislation, again, focused around sales and use tax and the other ones. All right, so I haven't had a chance to talk with you or Stephanie, so I don't mean to be hitting you blind or the legislative liaison. I forget his name. Anyway,
Farley.
all right, so apparently there's an ESSB 5814 extending sales tax to many services. All right, so this is the statement they made that it now includes, effective October 1st, that it would expand the sales tax base to additional services, including, and I'll just go right down to the one that live
Advertising.
presentations, both in person and via electronic means. And the presenter made a statement that in effect would tax us and the delivery of instruction, either in person or electronic means. Has your team, go
That's
ahead.
not true because
Okay.
there's a carve out in there that says, except for blah, 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 bona fide educational services and blah, blah, blah. There is a carve out in that bill. There's a more important one, though, actually, thing that does affect colleges. And we actually wrote, in with concerns on this. But it's somewhat small potatoes compared to others. It affects sales. It adds sales tax to advertising services, including billboards and banners at sports stadiums.
Oh, is there a minimum size of a sports stadium?
Nope. Nope.
Is there a definition of what it considers a sports stadium?
Yeah, pretty much any facility in which sports are played.
Okay, so it could be an open field and it
Yep.
can be good. Okay.
So the classic example is if you've got a baseball field and your outfield wall is made up of, advertising banners that you sell, you now have to charge sales tax for those and pass it along to Department of Revenue. So we did some analysis and we figured that, given how much we generally charge for that kind of advertising inside your gym, inside a baseball or soccer field, those kinds of things, that the overall tax impact to us was fairly low. The college or university that lost their freaking head over this was the University of Washington.
Course.
So they went in guns ablaze.
Isn't that for
They went in guns ablaze, trying to get that taken out, or at least an educational f sports facility carve out. But that didn't happen. So that is now a real thing in there. But the live presentations and that kind of stuff, that affects TED Talks. It does not affect, quote unquote, bona fide educational facilities.
them? Okay. So, I mean, that statement would also apply to our professional sports teams, correct? That are advertising. So, are you telling me, Troy, they're not going to do hot dogs from heaven anymore at the Mariners
At
games?
the Mariners
I'm
game.
bad. I'm going to call my legislator right now. It's an outrage on
I
hot
am
dogs from
really
heaven.
shocked that, honestly, given how crazy our society is, I'm really shocked that that part didn't die just because of the
Right.
Mariners and Seahawks and the
Yeah, the
Huskies.
rain, right, Sounders. I mean, all of it. Okay. Thank you, Choi.
So Troy, would that also apply? I mean, we have people that we pay to come in and do things at different events. So, they are educational related, but usually like, Women's History Month or, those kinds of things. Would that apply to the
Yeah, I think those would have been exempt automatically.
Okay. Thank you.
So there's a couple questions in chat, but you can see those now, right,
Yeah,
Joy?
I can.
Okay.
Kim, completely off topic, do your recommendations on the increases in fraud. Don't do it. I don't. This is something that we're really worried about. And there's been a group that's actually worked on this for a little while, and I think it's starting to ramp up again for lots of reasons, that because there's increasing new regulations on all of this, and there's other potential regulations coming down the pike from the federal government related to all of that. So I do think that there's going to be much more activity here shortly, where we're going to have to gather some system people together to talk through what some best practices are for that. So no like magic bullet from me, but just letting you know that this is really picking up steam again. Let's see, waivers for ungraded courses, specifically MT. Well, so once again, it's going to be dependent on the your local board's sort of structure for how they define that fee. So if it's considered like in the same category as un as continuing ed or corporate ed, that kind of thing, then your local board can waive whatever portion they want of that. If it's specifically a ungraded course that's actually coded as a state FTE, then the operating fee is the only portion in most cases that can be waived, unless the student falls into one of those categories where the full all tuition and fees can be waived. Yeah. Yes. All right. Other stuff? I heard from Terry that close is going to be the smoothest ever this year. So I'm counting on that as why you're just Terry's already. So I don't yeah I certainly don't want to jinx it, but I figured you're just so in shock from that statement from Terry. You're speechless and can't ask more questions.
I was going to ask what else do we need to know that we don't know?
The state board's hiring a new executive director. That process is actually just starting to end. Today is their last day of in-person interviews. And so that's interesting that there is the presidential group doing the allocation model review. There's a presidential group doing a review of the capital prioritization process as well. And so there's all sorts of stuff that fiscally it looks like it may have some changes coming up in the next few years. And the state agencies, AG's office, our office, SBCTC, and lots of other agencies are knee deep in responding to all the crazy stuff going on at the federal administrative level, and really starting to face some really interesting, weird things, where we're not able to get in contact with agencies because half the staff's been laid off. Other issues, cancellation of grants across the system, lots of just real heavy duty activity going on with the federal government and its various activities. So those are big picture things going on in the background.
Okay. Well, I tried to fill the time.
Yeah, that's
We have no
We have a couple things we could talk about until our next
We do.
yeah.
Yeah.
So thank you, Choi. Make sure
Okay.
you send me that presentation.
I will do that right after we get off.
Update your 18 to 28 first.
Okay. We'll do that. Okay. All right.
Going
Bye,
with 18 to
everyone.
15.
Yeah, exactly. Bye.
Bye.
So we have Oh, well, 20 minutes, almost 20 minutes until we actually take an official break. But if we wanted to, Sydney sent out the minutes from our last meeting. If we can get that, those approved, hopefully people had a chance maybe to look at them. Or we just need to, I don't know, how about this? Put your thumb down if you have an issue. If not, I say on consensus that they're approved. I'm not seeing any thumbs. So I say approved. And then just to start thinking, we'll do that if we have to do a vote, we'll do that at the very end. But I just want to start having the conversation that everybody trickles up. This is our last meeting for the year. Everybody trickles up, and that means we have a vacancy for a chair elect. The treasury and secretary technically are only 1 year terms. I think you could probably force Angela and Cindy's hands on staying on board unless you have a burning desire to take their roles on. I'm sure they would be more than willing to step down and let somebody else do it. It is a great leadership group. You get the insight, you get to help with the agenda and put the things that you want to listen to on it and try and find good speakers and all of that good stuff. It does. And the chair elect, Jennifer's back. That we don't make the chair elect do too much work. We just let you guys kind of, get your feet under you so that the next year you can run the show. So start thinking about that so that we can get somebody, because we do have to vote on that and have that done by the end of this meeting. And if nobody volunteers, I will
We will
nominate
voluntold
people.
somebody.
Yep. Which is usually how it works, because that's how Jennifer became the chair elect last time. So I have no problem throwing people under the bus.
Yeah, we plucked her out of the audience.
Yep. Does anybody have any questions regarding that? Anybody have any burning desire? I mean, if you want to throw it out there now, we could talk about it some more.
We are a fun group.
It's too bad this has to come right before year end. I think people are just kind of stressed about volunteering for anything right around this time of year.
Yeah, but you don't really have anything burning that you have to do for the most part until fall.
Yeah. Like early September is probably when they'll start rolling around the new meeting, and you're pretty wrapped up
By
with
then.
your by then. Yep. And I don't know if we did already pick the dates for next year's
And
October
the
16th
places.
and the places. Yeah, we already got people and places. So I know there were some budget concerns, and that's why we went Zoom again this spring. And I don't know that everybody's budget concerns have gone away, that's for sure. We figured we need to meet in person. Obviously, we all voted that we needed to be in person at least once a year, and that would be the fall meeting. And of course, we could still push the spring meeting to Zoom, but we wanted to have the dates and if we could meet in person already set. It's a lot easier to go to jump to Zoom if we have to versus finding a place and if we decided that we could do in person. So we got places and dates already for next year, which is great. We're already ahead of the game.
Yeah, and honestly, like I can't speak for being chair because I'm not chair yet, but for being the chair elect, it really was not a big time commitment or anything. It was pretty easy. And we're us accountants people, we get in the room and we're get it done people. So we don't waste a lot of time. So, and we kind of have fun together. So, come on down. I need some support. Come work with me.
Jennifer's fun. I
That's my
promise.
sales pitch. I don't know. I don't see any hands going up. So I don't know how good my salesmanship is.
It's easier to do this in person because you can see people's faces and guilt them into it. It's hard to
Right.
do when they're on Zoom.
Right. I'll throw some people out there in the next meeting. I'll start tagging some people and pressuring them. See what I can do. I mean, I could throw someone under the bus right now if I mean, I'm looking at some people like Kyoko hasn't
No,
What?
please. No, please.
No. No.
What, why you are doing this to us? Don't do it.
Well, I hear a volunteer.
Oh, there's really an
There's the
advantage to it.
Roche. I think he
Let me.
just volunteered.
Hey.
No, I didn't.
Yes, you did.
I did not.
Like, quite honestly, there's an advantage to it because if you're in the room, you're deciding like who do we want to present. So if you've got some things, some burning questions and things you want addressed, if you're in the room, you get to, you get more of a say. I mean, we're listening to everybody's say, but we don't always have a lot of people giving us ideas. So then we're just deciding, So there's another good reason to serve.
Yep. Let's see. Let me see who else I can throw under the bus, see if I can get some more people. I don't know. Kim from CBC's been around, a couple years now, and she's got some wings underneath her now. If I don't look, I'm not gonna look. I'm not gonna look. They can't. Oh.
And now I'm getting text messages with suggestions.
Yeah, see, there you go. Kim thought she was flying under the radar. No, never, never, never. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll give you guys some time to think about it. And we'll go on our break right now and be back at 2:45.